This is part 6 of The Horse and the Rider. It's one story that begins at part 1, so if you haven't heard that, go back. Six, the plaza. After the meeting with the hitman, Judith Senyol made a few calls to friends and associates who worked in museums and antiques.
Bas reliefs?
They asked her incredulously.
Stone carvings?
She swore and threatened them. After 2 days, a director at a prominent auction house who had sexual interests frowned upon by the police agreed reluctantly to sell her a small stone horse and rider carved by a Mesoamerican artist around 600 years ago.
30 grand,
Judith snapped. She withdrew the cash in one reckless transaction and arrived at the rowing club, where an undercover cop slid onto the seat next to her. Your acquisition of that carving is illegal, he muttered. She rolled her eyes. We know what it's payment for as well. Another cop slid onto the stool on the other side of her. It's not looking good for you, Judith.
Did that antique freak rat on me?
She demanded. But he hadn't. It was the auction house director who'd turned snitch. The antique freak hitman had died less than 20 minutes after they'd parted 3 nights earlier, when a recreational drone piloted by an inexperienced hobbyist slammed into his head and he'd toppled into the Parramatta River. When his body was discovered 3 weeks later, it was unrecognisable. Judith went to prison for 2 years, but that happened well after Peter disappeared and returned. A few metres above the road, stretched between metal pylons, was a billboard. It was an electronic billboard that could be remotely reprogrammed at any time, and as Peter and Jackie drove under it, it flicked over to show a picture of a clean, modern city on the bank of a river. On the white background was the slogan, Albury, getting on with business. There was a website and a line about how it had been paid for by the Business Council of Albury. Jackie flinched with surprise, then laughed a tiny indulgent laugh, and Peter looked at her curiously. What's funny? He asked. It was hard to articulate with the right gravity that she'd just been given a clear and unambiguous thumbs up from fate, and that the means of communication was billboard. Instead, she told Peter to turn right, and the scrubby trees and houses suddenly stopped, and paddocks of yellow grass opened up around them. In the distance, kilometres away, the road disappeared up a tree-crowded mountain. Peter tried to talk to Jackie. Well, it's nice to meet you, he said. Jackie was a polite person. Until now, most of what she'd said to Peter had been impatient and heavy with sarcasm, but that was understandable. He was a bland, nearing middle-aged man with a symmetrical face and a nice suit, the kind of person who'd guarded every door and affected a net negative influence on her life to date. Of course, he'd also caused the death of her grandmother. It was an event that her mind had played out many times before, and each time she'd been visited by the dream, she'd imagined feeling a rush of cataclysmic terror, of yawning chaos and eviction, and the end of everything normal. Jackie was not an overly emotional person, but she would cry in sad movies and sometimes when she saw an old dog, so it seemed logical that her grandmother's passing would trigger an outpouring of grief. But each time the scenario had played out in her mind, she could only account for the grief's presence, to make room for it. She couldn't feel it, not in a palpable way, like how you might wake up from a bad dream with your heart pounding and your hair stuck to your head with sweat. She didn't find it hard to reconcile her inability to preview the trauma of the grief. That was the nature of dreams. She expected it all when the time came. Eventually, the time came, and instead of the expected vomiting up of memories and feelings, she'd felt a kind of weary relief. It wasn't that she hated her grandmother, or that she was glad to see her dead, although it was true that she had hated her, and she was perhaps a little glad that she was dead. But as much as Cynthia had sabotaged Jackie's happiness wherever she could and treated her with a cruel and cynical coldness, there was no one to whom she had subjected that treatment more devastatingly than herself. She was a mean and angry woman, and she showed her anger to the world like a badge that read, "Don't try to swindle me or overcharge me or ask me for a favor or expect me to buy new things when the old things aren't broken." She wore old clothes and ate cheap, bland food she cooked in the same saucepan for every meal. She lived a frugal and joyless life and expected others to do the same, and if they didn't, they were selfish. "Weird thing to say," Jackie replied, but there was a slight softening in her voice. The anger from earlier had diminished. "I'm sorry about your Nan," Peter told her. "About what happened?" He paused and added, "Jackie." He'd wanted to say her name. It was a ridiculous thing to apologize to someone for killing their grandmother, but Jackie appreciated it in an odd way. "Cynthia," she told him. "Well," Peter said, "very sorry for Cynthia." Jackie remained silent. The car travelled slowly up the winding mountain road, and after a while, Peter worked up the courage to ask his passenger, "Where are we going?" It was a fantastic question, asked only slightly later than it should have been. Jackie seemed to know just where she wanted to go, and Peter's nature was to assume that someone who held strong opinions was probably correct. Nonetheless, the question of where he'd take himself had been snowballing in urgency in his own mind. He needed somewhere to lay low for a while. In his personal experience, problems sometimes went away if you ignored them for long enough, and perhaps paid a fine. In this case, he saw no alternative course of action. It would be a PR disaster if he was to be arrested on a manslaughter charge, and incredibly boring to spend time in jail. He had no wish to spend long hours in an interview room in some pokey police station, and he had faith that time and a thorough investigation would inevitably find that there was no way a man of Peter's impressive reputation could be responsible for the shabby old Greek's unfortunate ending. And his presence in any witness box would only invite a media circus. Yes, for everyone's sake, it was best if Peter Quinnell Live simply excused himself. What he needed was a place he could escape the eye of both the police and the public. A hideaway in some little town, small enough that it was possible to be hidden, but big enough that when it was necessary to emerge from hiding, his presence wasn't immediately noted. "South," she told him. "I've got a friend who lives down south." Of course, running away was the wrong way to respond to her grandmother's death, and Jackie was beginning to see that her plans should have been changed, and that maybe the fact that they hadn't would implicate her. But it was done now. The thought of turning her back on the thrilling new life that lay before her when she had only one foot out the door made her want to scream. Maybe Cynthia would sort herself out. "If you're going to escape," she offered, "you'll need a disguise." The thought took Peter by surprise. "Yes," he said. The thought was exciting. He drummed his fingers on the wheel as he warmed to the idea. So far his escape had felt too much like a mean little necessity. But here was a way to reframe it all. It could be a grand adventure. "Let's stop for a bit," Jackie said. They were at Fitzroy Falls Shopping Plaza. Here's the story of the plaza. The Woolworths was opened in conjunction with the Plaza Building with a grand launch party on a September day in 1993. At the opening ceremony, there were 300 coffee cakes that had been especially baked by the baker in the plaza, and there were to be cocktails and a dance by the water feature at the entrance. The man who was the Member of Parliament for the area at the time had driven from Canberra especially for the opening, and he used a big pair of golden scissors to cut the ribbon that stretched between two special golden bollards that symbolised the entrance to the plaza. There were speeches. A band from the local school set up under an awning at the back and played "When the Saints Go Marching In" and "Sat and Dolled." The mayor danced with the developer of the plaza. As the afternoon got underway, the owner of the new chip shop in the plaza noticed cracks in the pavers on the ground, and he mentioned something to the mayor, who told the developer, who told them he would make a few phone calls about it, then walked into the centre of the plaza to get a closer look at the cracks. As he did, a sound like a thunderclap filled the air. An enormous crack shot through the ground, and as the assembled guests looked around in terror, the pavers broke away underneath the developer's feet. People screamed as he tumbled into the hole, and then screamed again as a vast torrent of rats boiled over the edge and went scattering through the plaza. The men and women assembled there were sent screaming through the exits from the rats, who devoured the cakes and canapes and then turned on each other, fighting and cannibalizing until they finally dispersed into the fields and forests surrounding the plaza. for 3 days after it rained, and it was only when police divers jumped through the hole in the cement that they discovered the vast cavity underneath and the clean-picked skeleton of the developer. He had been eaten by rats, and the hole had filled up with rainwater and overflow from the water feature. His head was crushed underneath an enormous skull-shaped rock, and when the divers tried to push it off him to retrieve the body, they found their flippers and wetsuits made it nearly impossible. Because of the angle of the rock and its positioning in the large uneven hole that had formed, it was difficult to involve machinery of any kind. The police divers secured a harness around the rock and tried to winch it out, but the uneven concrete surfaces of the cavern snapped the cable. Eventually, the rock dislodged. It came crashing down in slow motion, narrowly missing one of the divers and trapping the developer's body even more perilously than it had before. The diver spooked and fled for the surface. He told his colleagues about the underwater tomb, and the situation rapidly developed into a protest. The police union became involved. No cop would go in the hole. The national president of the police union appeared on the news, flanked by uniformed officers in front of a dramatically floodlit cordon at the plaza site. Night after night for a week, he stared down the barrel of the TV cameras and told them,
"The hole is too dangerous. This site should be closed. I will not in good faith compel a police officer to enter that hole."
The mayor held a press conference as well.
"What happened is tragic," she said. "Our thoughts are with the family at this time and with the police officers who have tried so valiantly to retrieve the remains of our friend and colleague."
She refused questions. The local MP released a statement. "The police have done everything in their powers. We can ask no more of them," it read. In any case, nobody apart from the grieving family of the developer really wanted any police officers to enter the hole. There weren't enough police officers as it was, and the ones they did have were lovely men, family men, pillars of their community. It was wasteful to throw their lives away on a watery hole with a dead property developer in the bottom of it, and if there was one thing country folk wouldn't abide, it was waste. The developer's children printed out a petition and stood by a trestle table on the main street of Bowral for a few days. "Bring back our dad," the petition read in bold letters. And underneath, "Our dad, Marius Todd, died tragically at the Fitzroy Falls Plaza development site. His body is still in the freak sinkhole which formed. The police are refusing to do their jobs. Sign our petition and please help us bring home our dad." But nobody would sign the petition, and after a few disheartening days, they quietly packed up and accepted a payout by the insurance company to the tune of $7 million. The hole was filled in with cement, and the site was abandoned for 20 years, until a new luxury development that was looking to capitalise on the scenic bushland and surrounds purchased it from Marius Todd's estate for a dollar and recommenced work. Peter stepped out of the car and stretched weakly. The parking lot was bright and empty.
"Coming?"
he asked Jackie. She was not. The sliding doors of the gleaming new Woolworths wheeled open and a puff of chilled air refreshed him. A very old woman stood in front of the anti-theft barriers. She wore a green and white blouse, and when she saw Peter, she winked at him.
"Good to see you," she said.
Peter nodded but said nothing. He took the basket she held out to him and staggered into the supermarket. He was in the bakery section, and it seemed to him that the beige vinyl flooring tiles here were a little too much, a little too unbroken by display tables and shelving units to please his eye. He tried not to look at the beige, but the more he tried not to see it, the more he saw it. It stretched out before him in every direction. Butter croissants and cheese and bacon rolls stuffed into clear plastic boxes atop light wooden displays atop the beige floor again and again and again. His head hurt. The yellowing white of the ceiling crowded him. His tummy hurt. He whirled around in a panic, but the doors had slid closed. The old woman stood in front of them smiling benignly, but Peter detected the sinister implication in her stance. He was trapped. She knew. He could tell. A sob bubbled up into his throat. He looked pleadingly at her and mouthed, "I'm sorry." She wasn't looking. Peter turned to face her, and it caught her attention. He mouthed, "I'm sorry. Please don't tell." And her expression perked up.
"Are you all right, sweetheart?" she called out. "Do you need a hand?"
Peter exhaled. Was he safe?
"I'm all right, thanks,"
he called out and turned around in a way he thought was casual. Suddenly, he realized he was starving. A disgusting earthiness sat on his tongue and in his jowls, and every time he rearranged his mouth to talk or cough, he tasted it again. The room felt bright and sickening, and his head pulsed. He looked around in a weak effort to find something to scrub away the sensation, and as he did, his eyes fell on one of the round tubs of greasy butter croissants piled up on a display table. He staggered towards it and wrenched the lid off the nearest one. He stuffed an entire croissant into his mouth. It was stiff and stale, but Peter found it delicious. He ate another, and as he did, the room seemed to come into focus. The pulsing ache in his head receded. He ate another croissant. He ate a fourth croissant.
"Goodness me," a voice said. "We're hungry, aren't we?"
It was the old woman. She looked shrewdly at him.
"You'll have to pay for those, you know," she said. "When you finish shopping is fine. Just take the box to the register and make sure they scan it."
She turned her face to him and closed her eyes and smiled. Peter was overwhelmed by paranoia. What had marked him for her warning? Did he look suspicious? Did he have the bearing of a criminal?
I wasn't going to steal them," he told her. "I'm going to pay for them, of course."
He pulled his wallet out and made a show of the thick wad of bills inside.
"Just pay at the register, sweetheart," she told him, the benevolent patience in her eyes starting to waver a little.
Peter pulled out his credit card.
"Anything, anything, cash, card, you name it. I might even have my checkbook in the car," he proclaimed in as casual a voice as he could muster.
The old woman peered at the card.
"Ah, that's where I recognised you from," she exclaimed. "You're Peter from the news."
His stomach dropped.
"No, I'm not."
She looked at him.
"If you say so," she winked.
"I'm not," he repeated as tersely as he could. "Madam, I am not from the news. I don't know who you're talking about, but I am not he."
The old woman dropped her glance uncertainly.
"You even sound like him," she said, beginning to doubt herself.
"I've been told that," Peter replied, softening his tone.
He could tell his opponent was on the ropes.
"I thought you said you didn't know who I was talking about."
Her suspicion was renewed. Peter looked her up and down briskly.
"I don't," he barked. "And if you insist on the comparison, I'll be compelled to speak to your supervisor. Who is," he raised his voice, "who is your supervisor? I'd very much like to speak to the supervisor."
"Keep it down," the woman said. "There's no need for that."
A month ago, she'd been reprimanded for stealing cartons of cigarettes from the dock and taking them to the Woolworths in the next town and exchanging them for cash, and it was only because she was the mother-in-law of the store manager that she'd escaped a summary dismissal.
"Irene," her daughter-in-law had said, "if you put me in this position again, I'll have no choice but to fire you."
Irene's daughter-in-law hadn't been specific about what constituted this position, so if some shirty guy who looked like a news anchor wanted to not be compared to a news anchor, Irene considered it in her best interests to not compare him to a news anchor.
"Oh, I guess I was wrong. You don't look like a guy on the news,"
Irene told Peter, who nodded smartly, turned on his heel around the corner of the aisle, whipped the top off the box of croissants and volleyed a hot stream of nervous vomit into it. He slid the box underneath the shelves. From the display rack on the end of one of the checkout aisles, he grabbed a handful of $100 Woolworths gift cards. "Trace this," Peter thought with a thrill of excitement. The cops may track his bank debits and CCTV cameras may record him, but his supermarket gift cards would slip through their nets. He shivered with the strange chill you feel after you've thrown up and tottered unsteadily towards the cosmetics aisle to complete his preparations for life on the lam. Hair dye and scissors.
Thanks for listening to The Horse and the Rider. It's written, read, and produced by me, Max Laverne. I'd love to hear from you if you've been enjoying it. You can tweet at me, prawn_meat, or send me an email, maxlaverne@gmail.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can make a donation at ko-fi.com/maxlaverne. If you know anyone who's into creatures from fantasy realms, make sure you tell them about the podcast, because next week in episode 7, it's heavily implied that a character Peter meets is not human. So it's a great time to step through the wardrobe, as they probably say.